My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to AI Named This Show. I'm Tasia Custodi.
And I'm Tristan Jutra.
And we are your human hosts. It's a Google grab bag of sorts on this week's episode with some follow-up on Stability AI, Sora, and more. And Tristan, we're giving a very big hello or marhaban to our listeners in Saudi Arabia.
That was pretty good.
I mean, if you and I think it sounds good.
You're braver than me.
Then I think it's good. Okay, we have quite a bit of follow-up, but it's like, look, quickie follow-up, I want to call it. So kick us off with some DALL-E follow-up.
So OpenAI's DALL-E, which, as most of you may know, is an AI that generates images from text descriptions. And they've introduced new features to enhance the user experience. So these include in-chat image editing tools and preset style suggestions for inspiration. You know, for when you're staring at a blank page and you just want to play around, but like, where do I even start? I have that problem sometimes, and especially when you're just trying to learn the tool. Recent updates like DALL-E 3's integration with ChatGPT, which I believe happened last fall, they aim to simplify the process for users, allowing you to easily create and modify AI-generated images without needing to craft detailed prompts. And that was one of the key things with the integration into ChatGPT is you basically give it an idea of what you're looking for. ChatGPT will use its smarts, its language abilities to create a prompt. It knows DALL-E well. I mean, they're siblings, right? And it fires over a more detailed prompt to DALL-E, and then hopefully you get something with the right amount of fingers and teeth. Furthermore, OpenAI has begun watermarking and adding metadata to AI-generated images to help indicate their origin, although concerns about misuse by bad actors remain. Now, Tasia, this is the part where you tell me that Google Gemini has let you do this for a while with the tweaking the images as you go. Is that something you can do in Gemini? I haven't done a lot of images with Gemini myself.
Yes, you can. And you can do it to a certain degree of success, I guess. So the issue is, I say yes, but I guess that's not really that true. You technically can as a prompt, but it will never like tweak that exact image. Do you know what I mean? So like if you love the image, but you want to do one thing to it, at least in the times I have attempted, it regenerates a whole new image.
Ugh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
So the difference here, So the difference here in the demo that they posted on X was they were creating a cute poodle celebrating a birthday, but then they realized, oh, they wanted to add some bows. So you just have this in your follow-up request, you get it to add some bows. And to their credit, they show these demos in real time. So as long as it takes, they're not speeding anything up, you know, Google. So, it seemed like a long time for two very simple bows, but I mean, that was time that you didn't have to like muck around in Photoshop and do your thing. And, you know, these things are going to get faster and faster as time goes on. But I think this is welcome because, like you say, one of the great frustrations of using these image generators is, okay, it's not quite right, but you don't want it to reset the whole thing. And there are ways for advanced users to use, if you can figure out like the seed number, you can get tools, whether it's Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or I think Dolly 2, or Dolly as well, or Dolly 3, we're at now. But sometimes you got to dig around and you need to know what you're doing exactly. This basically hides that. It makes it transparent from the user. So it's keeping the seed number in its mind, knowing, okay, well, this is what we're working on right now. And we're just going to make some tweaks without you create, because it's so frustrating when you get something that's so close and then you just want a little bit of a tweak and then it's totally lost the plot. So yay, incremental improvements. Keep bringing them.
We love to see it. Well, do you remember, Tristan, months ago now, we talked about the whole quote-unquote George Carlin AI slash maybe not AI video, I'm glad I'm dead, that was posted to YouTube? Do you remember this whole situation?
Indeed and do, yes. Dudesy.
Yes. So we had talked at that time that George... his daughter had, Kelly Carlin had, you know, she was getting lawyers involved. We didn't really know what would come of it. I have a bit of an update for you. Basically, the estate and like Kelly Carlin, his daughter, accused Dudesy, who posted this, of infringing on copyrights by training its AI algorithm on like over 5 decades of George Carlin's work. So the two podcast creators, Will Sasso and Chad Kultgen, they have agreed now to permanently remove the comedy special and to never repost it on any platform. And then they also agreed not to use George Carlin's image, voice, or likeness on any platform without approval from the estate. So that's according to court records. Now, we're kind of unsure whether or not the settlement includes any monetary damages. That was kept confidential, so it has not been disclosed. But Kelly Carlin said, quote, "While it is a shame that this happened at all, I hope this case serves as a warning about the dangers posed by AI technologies and the need for appropriate safeguards." So I'm glad that she's gotten some resolution with that. And I, just like she's saying, I really hope that it helps kind of shed the light, if you will, on these type of issues that could happen, and what do we do to protect ourselves and protect our loved ones?
Yeah, and I guess if anyone wants to, if you haven't heard about the story, go back to episodes 22 and 23 where we talk about it a little bit. But as a public figure, there's going to be parodies of you, homages to you in various forms. So are we to expect that no one, like when you see all the images, all the illustrations that people may have done of any given public figure, George Carlin or otherwise, be they flattering or not so flattering, illustrations, impersonations, and whatnot, because the Dudesy thing, it was very clear from the up front, this is not George Carlin, this is AI, and we're just remixing or rewriting, you know, we're not claiming to be him, we're doing a George Carlin shtick. But where does the line get drawn? Is it just the fact that AI was involved? What if you had like, and you, so AI generated images of people, be they current, you know, living or dead? Is that like, how far are these lawsuits going to go?
I think it comes in the recreation though. And we're seeing all these tools that recreate our voices and recreate our likeness. And I think that's the problem when it's posing as you and it's using a recreation of your voice, of your face, or whatever it may be. That's very different than a sketch on SNL, as an example.
Well, the good news is, Teja, OpenAI's voice cloning AI model only needs a 15-second sample of you to work. Right? Perfect. And their voice engine is a new text-to-voice generation platform that can create a synthetic voice, like I said, from just a 15-second voice clip. And it's used in, this tech is used in ChatGPT's read aloud feature. So when you are using the voice capabilities of ChatGPT, and it's used by select companies for various applications like HeyGen, which we talked about last fall, that's OpenAI's tech in there as well. OpenAI requires partners to obtain explicit consent from original speakers to avoid impersonation and disclose AI-generated nature of voices. And watermarking, just like we were talking about with DALL-E 3, is added for traceability. In other news, the U.S. government, particularly the FCC, has taken steps to regulate AI voice technology to prevent unethical uses like spam robocalls. Mm-hmm. We had the Joe Biden calls last fall as well. using AI-cloned voices. So OpenAI suggests phasing out voice-based authentication. So there are some services where, you know, through a phone call or whatnot, you have to say, oh yeah, this is me, blah, blah, blah. And it uses its own kind of algorithms, its own sort of AI to say, oh yeah, that's you. Well, if the other, on the other side, the AIs can be used to recreate your voice so well, then maybe that's not such a great authentication scheme anymore. So OpenAI is also recommending developing policies to protect voice use in AI, educating people on AI deepfakes, and creating tracking systems for AI-generated content. It's a wild world. As I want to also remind folks, there was a story, it was before we got going, it was about a year, I think it was a year ago, Microsoft had a project called VALL-E, V-A-L-L-E, and similar tech, except it only needs 3 seconds. Of your voice to do amazingly lifelike recreations. And again, they haven't released that to the public. So OpenAI has got their stuff with 15 seconds. Microsoft's got their stuff. Maybe, I don't know if they're using some OpenAI tech in there too, but very, very few seconds. So there's that, the fear, and there's been stories going around. It's like, oh, you know, if you get some kind of robocall and they tell you to answer a question, don't answer the question because they're cloning your voice. And all of a sudden everyone's like spooked about answering their phone. I mean, I don't really answer my phone anyway if it's from an unknown caller. So maybe that's a good thing to do. Just keep your address book updated so you're not missing important calls. And it gets difficult when you're like expecting calls regarding healthcare and whatnot. But it's just another example of the wild world we're in now, where if people can use our voices to and clone our voices to authenticate on behalf of ourselves for certain sensitive services, now we're like even more paranoid of talking, and people are going to just stick to text even more.
I never answer my phone.
So in other audio news, we've talked about Suno AI recently, a few weeks ago, for creating some amazingly good songs, you know, and they're, you know, the tech has come a long way over the last couple of years in that department. But Stability AI has an audio generator. It's an upgraded music generation platform that allows users to create up to 3 minutes of audio from a text prompt, including an intro, full chord progression, and outro. This new version extends the maximum audio length from 90 seconds to 3 minutes. So what we're seeing is these models are letting us do more now. It's free to use and available on the website with options for text prompts, or you can upload copyright-free audio clips for analysis. So like if you're humming a few bars, maybe it's your own composition, you can upload that and it will riff on it for you. It'll analyze it and run with it. So while the technology showcases potential, the AI-generated music has been described as lacking the human touch, with vocals in an unrecognizable language, which we've seen with some other platforms as well, and occasional oddities in the audio output. So I gave this a try myself, and I can concur, it's pretty generic sounding stuff for the most part. And actually, I couldn't even get it to generate vocals. So maybe that was just user error on my part. But then, just out of curiosity, I went back to Suno AI, and they're at version 3 now. So they've recently progressed from version 2 to version 3. They're still limited to 2 minutes, but the quality is a fair bit better. And it's writing lyrics, and the vocals are wild. So, and it's just even better than it was last time we checked in with Suno.ai. So again, we got this arms race going, all these folks working on these different types of models, be they LLMs or tech or image generation, or, you know, voice cloning or music. It's never ending. And these are just getting better and better, which, you know, of course, raises some concerns for some folks that we'll talk about in a little bit. But, you know, music's one thing, but music videos now too, Tasia.
Yes, we talked a lot about Sora, OpenAI's Sora video generator in the past. And I just wanted to give you a really, really quick update. And we will put this YouTube video in the show notes. But there was a music video designed to capture images that musician August Camp visualized in her mind while she was composing this piece. So think of it like a fever dream, you know, like artists, and they have these shots in their mind. We don't know exactly what the prompts were. to get, like, say, each scene. But Camp is also a researcher. She's a creative activist. She's obviously a very talented musician. And she is one of the artists that was given early access to Sora to play around with it. And she sees it as what she calls a turning point for artists, as it means the only limitation on visuals is your imagination. So it's kind of a real trippy, almost like old filmy style fever dream.
Approach like the crystal in the hedge labyrinth.
Things that don't make quite a lot of sense, but it's shot kind of in a composition like your dreams would be, where maybe some things aren't fully in frame, or it's a little hard to explain, but it's kind of wild to be like, it just did the whole thing? Cool. So I'm curious to see if she will come out and say, like, what her prompts were, how she prompted. Was it each individual scene? Did it stitch the whole thing together by itself? Like, I'm just so curious about some of the details, but it's very cool. And we will link to that in the show notes. Tristan, I feel like every day we could have another Sora update. So this was one of the ones I thought was the coolest one. So
definitely getting some like 70s, early 80s phantasmagorical vibes, you know, from strange, cosmic, horror thrillers, almost Lovecraftian in a sense, sort of dark passages and mysterious symbols and diagrams and allusions to other life forms. And it's quite cool. But so the opportunities for artistic expression are really, really opening up to folks with tools like this, as we see them within wider and wider release. So the question is, like, when with a tool so powerful as Sora and as compute intensive as it will be, I can't imagine OpenAI just saying, okay, now it's just part of, ChatGPT Plus. You're getting DALL-E 3 in there, and now you're going to get Sora, because just the resource intensiveness and the expense on the back end. Microsoft's been throwing lots of money at OpenAI, but it's not limitless supply. So I can see a day where they may add additional tiers if you want the extra features. I mean, people have been paying for Discord for Midjourney through Discord for a couple of years now, and the serious users will surely be okay with paying for the kind of power that these tools like this offer. But speaking of artists and music and all that kind of thing, over 200 musical artists, including Billie Eilish, Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest, Pearl Jam, REM, Stevie Wonder, and yes, even your queen, Tasia, Taylor Swift, they have signed an open letter by the Artist Rights Alliance, known as the ARA, criticizing AI's use in music, stating that it infringes and devalues human artists' rights. The letter reflects historical apprehensions artists have had toward technological advances like synthesizers and digital sampling. Thankfully, both of those went away. suggesting AI might integrate into music production despite current fears. Yes, I think they can probably bank on that. The signatories acknowledge AI's potential to enhance creativity, but express concerns about AI replacing human artistry, diluting royalties, and harming the music ecosystem. So the Artist Rights Alliance urges AI developers and tech companies to pledge against deploying AI music generation technology that undermines human artists or denies fair compensation. Artists say that AI will set in motion, set in motion a race to the bottom that will degrade the value of our work.
Them's fighting words.
And are we to believe then that the tools, the very inexpensive tools that have been given to basically anyone with a laptop, an iPad, or even a smartphone nowadays, GarageBand and otherwise, free tools, cheap tools, plugins, some of which have been powered by AI previously before people were, it was cool to talk about AI, other just, loops and stuff that you could get. Like, people have been cranking out reams and reams and reams of slop for a couple of decades now. And what that's not devaluing music, it is harder than ever to break out in music because anyone can do it. So honestly, I think AI is the least of their problems. It's just one more thing. It talks about them having railed against synthesizers and samplers in the past. Well, yeah, sampling is a thing because, you know, we've got to be, you know, and unfortunately, the art of sampling has become dead now because the legal mumbo jumbo you have to get through to be able to, you know, use anything nowadays. You wouldn't have been able to do the first couple of Beastie Boys albums or Pop Elite Itself albums or anything like that nowadays because it's just too much red tape, too much of a headache. But, you know, tech has been going hand in hand with artistry ever since we evolved from cave paintings and banging rocks together to make music. It's just one thing after another. So honestly, this in my mind, this is great that they're signing this letter and everything, but to expect the people who are making this tech to like make special concessions or considerations for the artists, I'm not sure how much traction that's actually going to get in the real world.
Well, we're going to see if this actually goes anywhere, Tristan. That's all any of this is.
Yeah, you can only fight it so much. And I get it. Like, I think we need to be mindful of things like copyright, impersonation as you make, you know, deep fakes and all that kind of stuff. And you know, they are acknowledging that there's tools, but, you know, they just want to get paid. I mean, let's just tell it like it is. They want to get paid. But like, there are a lot of artists out there that would not be able to do what they're doing without the tools that have been gifted to us by tech companies, hardware makers, software makers, and the like. And we can debate the quality of that. But like, this has been an issue since long before AI. So,
well, we have to see where we draw that line, I guess, is the issue.
Stop devaluing music is what they're saying, Teja.
Okay, that's a little vague, but...
And, you know, there's also something called Spotify, which barely pays people for their streams, but that's another whole discussion.
That's so, the Spotify stuff is a stuff for another day. Exactly. Today is the Google stuff.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Well, yeah, we're getting into Google now. So, of course, if these artists had their way, they might, you know, push for some regulations. But Sundar is talking about regulations lately.
Well, so actually, Sundar Pichai said that he wants AI to help Google comply with global tech regulations.
What, like to read all the legislation?
Make the AI do it.
Fill out the paperwork.
Right. So, I mean, we all know that regulations regarding AI technologies are starting to take shape. We've talked about it a lot on this very podcast. But speaking at the Stanford School of Business, Sundar Pichai gave his take on those regulations. And he talked about the difference between overregulation and underregulation and other key aspects of AI tech. And what he said in the forum raised some eyebrows. So, you know, I love a quote. So I'm going to give a little Sundar quote here. He said, quote, "The way I think about AI is, what part of AI will make it easier for us to comply with regulation at scale? It's an opportunity there as well." So it did raise some questions. Like, my first question is, well, like, how? How? What's your plan? Like, how is it going to help AI? How is it going to help Google comply with regulations? I would just like to know, like, what exactly do you mean, Sundar? So we're gonna
just
see.
Watch the 2-hour video to find out. Yeah, or get AI to summarize it for you.
Exactly. But we will soon see, you know, what Google wants to do to help it boost its AI footprint. As we know, they've been making some moves, Tristan. So it's kind of just interesting. I'm just curious. I love when companies and heads of companies make statements like this and you're like, but I have a lot of questions. I want to know the whys. I want to know the hows. I want to know strategically what you're doing and why you think the AI can help you. So there's just still a bit of question mark I have. But as I mentioned to you, Tristan, they're making moves.
He's got some help.
And yep, he's got some help. And there's been some shifts with Google Search and the team that leads Google Search. So Liz Reed, she's been at Google for more than 20 years. She now heads up Google Search and has most recently been working on Google's SGE, you know, the search generative experience. And there's been a few other shifts and changes too in the team as well, which all of these moving parts point to the fact that Google may very well believe that AI is the future of search. So you and I had talked about that when SGE came out, and now this is kind of like them bulking up, if you will, and ramping up to the next iteration of that. Example could be, I mean, you kind of can already do this in Google, but let's pretend this is at the next level of like reverse image searching, where you could theoretically in the future throw in a picture and, you know, like say right now, if you do that on Google, it'll give you cool, like, similar objects or something as close to it as it can find, okay, like on an image search, which is really cool if you like a jacket or you like, I don't know, it does a decent job of like finding some, at least something similar. But picture if you could put something into search and ask like a pretty general question about it, and then it gives you that exact product or what you need for that brand or model without you having to put all that detail in. So that could be really cool. Or
yeah,
maybe,
like say something like, what's the, you know, show me the 65-inch version of LG's latest OLED TV.
Yeah.
And it'll just like, and it's got enough context there to go, it knows what year it is. It, you know, it knows what the, you know, last year's models were, what this year's models were, you know, what that size means, and maybe shows you a few links where you can get it on Amazon, Best Buy, et cetera.
And then contextually from there, even carrying on with a conversation and a follow-up, mm-hmm. which, you know, we're already seeing that with SGE, where like, okay, example of the TV, I have a room with more light or less light, or this is the space I have between the windows, or what, you know, like you could get really granular now and have these conversations. You could be on the go and do a voice search maybe in the future and just prompt your LLM and have a conversation about something you need while you're out and about, and not have to actually physically Google something like we've
grown accustomed to. And the question being whether the large, like the super large language models like Google Gemini and OpenAI, if their capabilities will continue to scale, or if we're going to have better results with the smaller models the ones that are grounded in, you know, local domains of expertise, being, you know, fed information on, you know, tech products or the like. Because sometimes, you know, with the larger models, they've got so much information in their heads, and they sometimes can get confused and deliver up kind of the wrong version mm-hmm. of what you're looking for. And, you know, the dream is to have our general purpose search engines like Google just do that for us. And like you said, have a conversation. And it just that way you don't have to be like a search engine ninja to be able to find exactly what you're looking for. Just have an actual virtual assistant that we've been dreaming of for decades now.
Well, and Sundar Pichai has been saying for years that language models and other AI systems can both improve the quality of search results and also completely change the way we think about gathering information online. I think it's just more so like on our end as consumers, do we want that? Like, do we want search to be separate? Do we want AI in our search? Like, am I there for facts and links that are fact-checked and based, or do I want AI in my search, or do I want it separate? I think is what we're going to have to think about and dictate to these companies, because at the end of the day, we hold the power, people. So I always say with people, we hold the power. They can make the changes, and if you don't like it and you don't use it, that change is going to go away. You understand? But Reed said in a recent LinkedIn post, quote, "We're able to serve a wider range of information needs and answer new types of questions, including more complex questions like comparisons or longer queries. And there's more coming soon," she said. So I'm assuming that the future is going to look a lot more like the SGE kind of version, where you're getting answers rather than links.
So just if you're a website publisher that relies on ad revenue, maybe start working on other streams of income.
Yeah.
Because we talked about disintermediating web publishers and even YouTubers. If people can search transcripts, you know, with, you know, asking AI, YouTube AI questions about stuff, people won't need to watch videos anymore, read blog posts anymore, go to websites anymore. The all-powerful SGE and its competitors will do it all for us. And the yikes.
Yikes. Well, for Reed's part, she said that's one of the biggest challenges is like figuring out how to cite the answers that it gives and then also be a good partner, you know, to the open web, if you will. So it's kind of interesting to see, like right now with SGE, it shows this, not only the sources and the links beside the answer. So like, I like the little summary at the top that it gives, because right to the right are the links you can go through. And then when you click on one, it takes you bang right to highlighted text of where that summary has pulled that info from. So I'm digging that. Yeah. But I do feel like there's still, I can't say I like the SGE, but I can't say it's actually saved me time yet, because I'm still fact checking everything and I'm still going back through links. And because I don't want to rely on SGE, because sometimes the summaries are wrong. It just pulls something that's just not accurate. And so then I scroll down. And so right underneath the summary is your same old Google search like you're used to. So I just scroll down to those links and go, oh, you know, like, you know, how you have summaries under the links anyway. I'll read through some of those and just go, oh, that actually seems more accurate than what the SGE gave to me. So then I'll just go through those links anyway. So I can say it's actually saving me time. So it'll be interesting to see like this balance of what they strike. And also, again, as we always say to everybody, please don't rely on any of these LLMs. Like, always fact check your stuff, you guys, because as cool as this stuff is, if it's pulling a bunch of information from the open web, if a cuckoo nut is out there with a ridiculous blog that's popular and it pulls some bull from that blog and you just take that for a fact, like, you just have to check. You just have to check. So, but I'm a researcher, you know, like I don't mean that as a, I'm not a paid researcher. I don't mean it like that.
Yeah.
I'm not a scholar, y'all. Okay.
You're not doing surveys professionally.
I go down rabbit holes of research. Like when I'm going to go on a trip or when I'm going to make a purchase, like I scour every corner of the interwebs. So I think people just have to be a little more diligent sometimes, and it's okay if it takes you an extra click. Do you understand?
And I guess those AI results just got to get better and better, because maybe they're going to want you to pay for them eventually.
Well, there is a new Financial Times report that they are saying, quote, three people of knowledge of Google's plans. So take that at its word. They claim Google might start charging for access to search results that use generative artificial intelligence tools. Now, to be clear, charging for any part of the search engine would be a first for Google. It's really been funded solely on ads since like 2000. It's not surprising that Google would charge for AI enhancements, because as we know, all the plans they have, like the AI premium plan, what is it, like the Google AI premium one plan or whatever the heck it's called now for like Google One subscription, that's $10 more than like your standard premium plan, while the Gemini business plan is $20 more than a standard Google Workspace subscription. So we already know like they charge for the AI tools themselves, if you will. But under this proposed plan, Google's standard search without the AI would of course remain free, but then subscribers to a paid AI search tier would still see ads alongside their Gemini powered search results. This is all, again, remember, according to this report by the Financial Times. So search ads which, by the way, brought in about $175 billion for Google last year.
It's still like at least 90% of their income, right?
Yes. So, but,
and that's what's at risk with all this AI stuff just answering the questions for us. People aren't going to be clicking on those ad links so much anymore. So yeah, maybe subscribe, folks.
But that might not even be enough. Like that revenue, which it'll go up even more next year, depending. Mm-hmm. Probably wouldn't even be enough to cover the increased costs involved.
Bingo.
With AI powered search.
They're getting it from both sides. It's
yeah. Yeah.
are we this is not financial advice, but should we be shorting Google stock?
This is not a financial podcast. I gotta put our disclaimer in now. Well, like, okay, so I brought this little report from Reuters from last year that suggested that running a search query through an advanced neural network, something like a Gemini, likely costs 10 times more than the standard keyword search. So this could potentially represent several billion dollars of extra costs across Google's network. So they have to charge. They're going to have to charge. I mean, I don't know what's the solution. You're not going to have enough
ads.
It's
all of our responsibility. If we want Google to survive and thrive, for every AI query, we need to click on 10 ads.
Screw up your algorithm. You're going to get ads for really weird stuff once you start clicking on everything. Great solution, TJ.
but see, this is the nut of the issue is that ads work. Ads are very lucrative. And in other cases where, like, we've talked about Netflix here, maybe it was on our other show, Momentous Live, where Netflix has gotten rid of their lowest non-ad supported tier and replaced it with an ad supported tier because they make more money from the ads than they do from the lower subscription fees. And there are cases like in Europe where Facebook was compelled by the EC, the European Commission, to offer ways to for people to use Facebook without having their tracking and having personalized ads and all that stuff. So Facebook said, okay, well, we'll charge you X number of dollars a month. And then the EC is like, well, we don't want you to charge people. And then Google's like, well, maybe we shouldn't have Facebook in the EC then, because if we can't charge people subscriptions and we can't show them relevant ads, thanks to our tracking and personalization and all that, like, what are we even doing here? Mm-hmm. So there's a few reckonings to come with regard to business models and what people are willing to pay for, because people love free. I mean, you're the queen of freemium, as we know. So, and it's a privilege issue for some people. Like, those, you either pay with your money or you pay with your time and attention. Like, we only just recently started paying for YouTube Premium, so I don't have to sit through the increasing ad load of non-skippable ads on YouTube nowadays, and it's a game changer. But for the family plan, like, that's like pushing $25 a month Canadian. So that's not for everyone, right? So
no, it's just crazy. And the ads on YouTube drive me nuts, by the way, and I'm still mm-hmm. too cheap to pay for premium. And I'm a YouTuber. I'm not giving them any more of my freaking money. They're still stealing my money. YouTube, you owe me money. You're still stealing my money. If nobody knows what I'm talking about, go to my YouTube channel.
Did we just earn an explicit tag for this episode? Did I hear that right?
No. I said they're stealing my money. Did I swear and I don't even know it? Riled up. But okay. But my legit question for you is AI search or something like it a real threat to Google? Like, is it going to kill Google as we know it and as we've come to love and as it's become in our zeitgeist of just Google it? Like, nobody says just Yahoo it. Nobody says just Bing it. It's just Google it.
They tried.
So is it actually a threat?
So with that in mind, Teja, there's just a little article from David Pierce at The Verge, which explores whether AI search engines can actually kill Google at all. Are they actually a threat? And he is not convinced at this point. So a few of the key issues the article covers. He talks about how AI struggles with navigational queries, where you might be seeking a specific website and Google has got that locked in. It knows where stuff is. It has done a pretty good job of organizing the world's information. It's efficient and speedy in providing direct links, for example. Whereas with, you know, AI-generated answers, sometimes things will be, you know, footnoted and you can click on it, and sometimes it'll take you to an actual, like, first-party source. A lot of times, it's taking you to third-party sources, which may or may not be credible. So, you know, there's a bit of a gap there. For informational queries, AI's performance is mixed, sometimes providing outdated or contradictory information, compared to Google, which tends to be pretty accurate and quick. Like, they've refined their algorithms for decades now, and they... People might not realize it, but Google tweaks their algorithms more than once a day, like up to 500 times a year. They're always, you know, because there have been ebbs and flows in the quality of Google. There was a time, I remember, in the early 2000s where there was a lot of crap on Google thanks to content farms and the like. People were really gaming the system. They were Google bombing, and it was a mess for a while. It, then Google got smarter. They kept refining their algorithms. Now, the challenge is all the AI-generated sludge that is, you know, potentially polluting the web, and Google's got to figure out a way to navigate, to figure out what's original content and what is sort of rehashed or recapitulated content. One of the examples that Pierce gives is he was using Perplexity, which I've been using a fair bit as a kind of speedy AI search engine. We've talked about it previously. Pierce went and asked Perplexity, who won the Warriors game last night? And even though as an LLM, Perplexity understood the query, it gave the score for an earlier game in the team's schedule. It wasn't the last game. So if it can't figure out basic stuff like that, then they've got some work to do. Google, on the other hand, has pretty good data pipes to key information that people are searching all the time, because they have decades worth of people's search behaviors. And so when you see you ask for things like sports scores or, you know, weather or, you know, flights, you know, stock quotes, all, you know, there's even built-in tools like, you know, calculators, you know, it's all part of Google's broader ecosystem. So, you know, with Google using its AI, I think it's got the advantage there to some third parties like Perplexity, which have to do a bit more heavy lifting.
Yeah. And by the way, with things like sports scores for everyone, you can just add like your preferred sport, like league, sport, and team, and it's right there in your Google app. Under the search bar, you don't have to search anything. You can just open your Google app and you'll see the updated score to the game. Just as a quick tip for everybody. Nerd so, alert.
And that's good stuff. I wish, I was going to rant about something unrelated, but we're not going to go there right now. So overall, Pierce suggests that while AI has potential, its current form as a chatbot may not be the ideal interface for search, despite all of what we've just been talking about for the last few minutes. He emphasizing the complexity and multifunctionality of modern search engines just beyond providing links or answers. And I think Google is kind of the gold standard for that right now. Again, much to the chagrin of some original data sources, because they do disintermediate publishers to a large extent, you know, Google Answers being another case of that. So again, will the AI search disrupt Google in such a way that it harms it, or will Google take advantage of AI search well enough to disrupt itself and it will be fine? I kind of tend toward the latter myself. And Tasia, I know you're a Google gal. How do you feel?
I think Google will be just fine. That's my take.
So
let us know what you think. I'm always going to be in Google's corner.
Exactly. Are you in Google's corner? Let us know at feedback@ainamedthisshow.com. We've seen increasing pressure from OpenAI, from Microsoft, from Perplexity, from Anthropic, from Meta, and they all do varying qualities of jobs at pulling information from the web, you know, dealing with facts as opposed to just, you know, writing poetries and term papers. Let us know what you think. Feedback@ainamedthisshow.com. Is Google going to disrupt itself, or is it going to get disrupted by others in the whole AI search game?
Let us know what you think. And a very big thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of AI Named This Show. If you did enjoy this episode, please leave us a rating, a review, 5 stars on all the things we would be preferred. But you can do that. You can leave a rating and review on whatever your preferred podcast app is. Since Tristan, what? Google Podcast is officially another one bites the dust.
joining Google Reader. Mm-hmm. Don't even get me started.
I loved Google Reader.
Pour one out for Google Podcasts. You got to go to YouTube now because that makes sense.
Sorry, I forget it's a podcast. I just rolled my eyes so hard they got stuck in the back of my head. I would just like to explain that to everybody. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening.
AI balls and goodbye balls. Doesn't sound good.
No, we're leaving it in. That's it.
That did not turn out how I expected. Should really think these things through. Is Google getting neutered?
It's in the show. I'm not editing that out, so...
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.